From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. It's hard to believe that Paul McCartney is 70 years old, not only because he looks so great and still sounds great and puts on concerts that are close to 3 hours long. It's hard to believe McCartney is 70 because it seems like yesterday, no pun intended, that the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan and changed my life, and your life too. Time magazine is celebrating the occasion with a beautiful scrapbook dedicated to Paul McCartney. The text, and there's quite a bit of it, was written by one of our favorite writers, James Kaplan. James Kaplan is the author of Sinatra, The Voice, the first half of a definitive biography of the chairman of the board, and is hard at work on the second volume. He's also written for some of our best magazines, including a nifty profile of Aaron Sorkin in a recent Vanity Fair. Yet he still makes time for us. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, come on, Gary. I'm thrilled. There's no place on the radio I'd rather be.
Well, you know, we've talked a bunch about Sinatra and the old days, and here now we're talking about the not-so-old days when we talk about Paul. But I want to pick your brain about the difference between the songwriting of Paul McCartney and Lennon and McCartney and the songwriting of some of our favorites like Jimmy Van Heusen. I mean, let's take a song like, say, It Could Happen to You. It's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
Being recorded at first and then everybody else recorded it. And it didn't matter who recorded it, it's still a beautiful record.
Yes.
But a song like Yesterday, which I know was recorded by 57,000 people, but it really only needed to be recorded by one guy.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it was Alban Berg who said music is music, and it is. It sounds simplistic, but it is something that I deeply, deeply believe. I think that a well-crafted song is a well-crafted song no matter which century it happens to fall in, or which half of which century it happens to fall in, and whether it's written by Schubert, Brahms, Jimmy Van Heusen, or Paul McCartney and John Lennon. And I think that when you look at the oeuvre of Lennon McCartney and then the astounding continuing oeuvre of McCartney, what you see is a whole unbelievable raft load of extremely well-crafted songs.
In almost every genre. I mean, he can write songs in every style, as he proved in his most recent record, Kisses on the Bottom, where there's a couple of songs tucked in there that, you know, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know that they weren't old songs because they're perfectly matched to the era that he...
And there's one I want to call attention to in particular, and that is the sort of signature song of the album, My Valentine, which is... I think it addresses your theme and our theme of the astounding fact that this guy is 70 years old. He's not only 70 years old, he does remain young, and yet he has had an extraordinary amount of loss in his life, beginning with the loss of his mother when he was 14 years old, and the death of his first wife, Linda, both from breast cancer. And so this song, My Valentine, is written to his present wife, Nancy Chevelle, and it's a very striking piece of music. It's written largely in a minor key, and it is as distinct from so much of McCartney. It is more shadows than light, I think. And so I think what you're hearing and seeing in this song is the acceptance and the understanding of the loss that he's experienced, which he's always kind of he's always kind of pushed through before and jollied his way over, and I think some sort of acceptance of age.
Yeah, you know. You kind of just alluded in that comment to the, I think, the unfair reputation that Paul McCartney has. You know, there's always been this thing, especially since 1980, that John Lennon was the greatest and could do no wrong, and everything he did was fantastic and fabulous and hard-edged and rock and roll, and McCartney was the sappy one who wrote all the corny crap.
Yes, and yes, exactly. And McCartney is on record as referring to Lennon in that context as Martin Luther Lennon. So there you have it in a nutshell. McCartney's a tough egg. He's always been a tough egg. He comes from tough Irish Liverpool stock, showbiz loving and old musical loving, but Liverpool, you've been there, I've been there.
Yes.
Is a it's a tough place, and it is it's a port town. It is filled with it's filled with history, not all of it wonderful history, not all of it sweet history. It was one of the hubs of the slave trade in the 18th and 19th century, and a lot of tough characters have moved through and lived in Liverpool. And I think that the inhabitants, a number of whom I've had the privilege to know, have a very distinct sense of humor and sense of life, which has a good deal of harsh humor around it. And McCartney is very much part of Liverpool in that regard. He and Lennon make a fascinating contrast in characters, but I would assert, and I think you would too, that the contrast in their characters is much more complex than usually presented.
Yes, and it's definitely not that conflict that thing that we were just talking about, where one always does this and the other always does that, because you know, you can just listen to Julia and Helter Skelter and
yes. Or I'm Down, which is one of my favorite screamers of all time. And it's McCartney, and he can still do that with his voice, which nobody can quite understand.
Yeah, you know, we're both Sinatra fans, and Sinatra, you know, around the time he was 68, 69, he kind of found this new kind of lower register in his voice and did some fine recordings for a period there. But most singers, by the time they're 70, are pretty much done singing.
Yeah.
Even Bing Crosby's voice kind of was torn up, you know, by that time.
Mm-hmm.
Some singers, you know, Paul Simon has kind of reclaimed his voice a little bit, but, you know, Bob Dylan, he can't sing at all.
Mm. Yeah, well, there are those who would claim he never could, but
I'm not one of them. I think he was once a great singer.
Yes, but, no, I agree with you.
But McCartney still sounds so great.
He has extraordinary pipes. I think that he takes better care of them than he likes to give out. He likes to sort of pretend that he does nothing. He is, but if you look into his backstage rituals before his performances, there are lots of lozenges and herbal teas involved.
Yeah, but you know, you just hit on another interesting point of McCartney. That is, he is a guy who pretends to be, not necessarily pretends to be, but appears to be this very, very relaxed, easygoing, really normal kind of guy.
Yes.
And he's not exactly.
Well,
that.
I would maybe elaborate on that a little bit and say
please
that
do.
He both is and isn't. There is a part of him that is that sort of helplessly is a regular guy, a regular Liverpool guy, and that deeply wants to be that guy. And that would be maybe about 40%. And then 60%, 60% is the greatest superstar of the last 50 years and a genius.
Well, you know, he is a musical genius. He's probably the most musical person that's ever walked the face of the earth. I mean, if the only thing that he ever did was play bass in the Beatles, he'd be remembered as one of the greatest bass players that ever lived.
He's an extraordinary bass player, and by the way, an extraordinary drummer, too.
Right. If you listen to, say, Maybe I'm Amazed, and you just take them a minute to focus on each instrument as it comes by, and they're all him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a complicated cat. He likes to give out that he's a regular guy and that he is sunny and easygoing. He is, I won't say who said it, but one of the people I spoke to in the course of reporting this small book called him a Mafia Don in a cashmere jacket. I think he meant it in a not entirely uncomplimentary way. He is he's a McCartney is an extremely powerful man. He is concerned with power and the uses of power. He scares people. His aura, his achievements, and he has an intimidating air about him, even as he strives to seem like the normal bloke from down the street.
We're chatting with James Kaplan, and his latest book is a tribute, I guess, to Paul McCartney, a scrapbook with some beautiful pictures published by Time magazine and on your newsstands right now, I believe. When you say, though, a mafia don, I mean, he's not the kind of guy who's going to have a horse's head put in your bed or anything.
He's not, but he has always been extraordinarily protective of his music, his copyrights, his compositions. He, on at least one album, post Lennon's death, reversed the order of Lennon-McCartney to McCartney-Lennon on those songs that he felt he had more of a hand in, much to the chagrin of Yoko Ono. He doesn't hide his light under a bushel. He is not, to mix the metaphor and throw in another cliche, he is no shrinking violet. When it comes to his art, he knows exactly not only how good he is, but how great he is. And he is, as all the world seems to know, one of the world's richest, certainly one of the world's richest musicians, and one of the wealthiest people in the world. And he hasn't done that by being shy.
I mean, he came out of the Beatles with not a whole lot of money, so he really has made a fortune since then.
Yes. Yes.
But the thing about the credit, the switching of the credit, and I know he was really pushing for Yesterday to be changed, and he was saying that, you know, if you look up Yesterday on the computer, you know, because computers tend to abbreviate, it would say John Lennon, if it left out the Lennon and McCartney part.
Yeah.
And so that's why he wanted it reversed. But I really wonder, you know, why a guy with his level of accomplishment and money and fame, why he would care about that. And I also wonder why Yoko Ono would care.
Well, those are two entirely different, and in the latter case, I think it's an exceedingly complicated issue, and I could speculate on Yoko Ono's psyche, but I should address Paul McCartney and say that I believe that he may have all that wealth and fame, but this is what's important to him in the end, is the writing of the songs. This is what is closest to his heart. I think it is just absurd to have Lennon's name on that song, which has nothing of Lennon in it, and equally absurd, I guess, as long as we're going to make the case, to have McCartney's name on Julia and on any number of other Lennon solo songs. That said, there are a lot of songs that are mostly Lennon that McCartney contributed a middle eight to and helped out a lot with, and vice versa.
You know, I think I disagree. I think maybe, in fact, I think they should all just be credited to the Beatles, because as Paul was saying the other day, if you watched Martin Scorsese's film about George Harrison,
I did.
He says, "And I love her." Do 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 do, and he goes, you know, that part, the do 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 do, that's the whole song, and that was George.
That was George. It's true.
So what makes the Beatles so great, and why their music is so much superior to any of their solo work, which is also great, is because you had five people, the Beatles and George Martin.
Yes.
Hammering them out, you know, they would come in with a piece of raw material, and there would be a certain amount of competition to see if they could get their song on the record. You know, I mean, they didn't have room to put All Things Must Pass on any Beatle record.
Yeah.
You know, so there was like a lot of competition, and you know, the working together to take it from a song and make it a record.
Yes.
is something that was a collaborative effort.
Yes, no, you make a good case, and yet I would make the counter assertion that so many of what we would call the Beatles songs really had their origin and their fruition with as John Lennon used to say, John and Paul sitting looking up each other's noses, that intimacy between those two men, which began when they were teenagers, and then slowly unwound and exploded, was so key to what they produced, and the light and the dark, the yin and the yang, whatever it is you want to call, but which people tend to cast in simplistic terms, but is so much more complicated than that.
I love the picture in the book of John and Paul. They're wearing their suits and they're sitting. It's funny that the way they're dressed, and they're sitting side by side, and they're writing. I saw her standing there,
yes,
in Paul's living room on Forthland Road in Liverpool.
Yes, and that picture taken by Paul's younger brother Mike is on the wall of 24thland Road, exactly in the corner where they were sitting when they
right over the couch that's in the picture.
Right over the couch, right by that little coal fireplace in that tiny little house.
Yeah, so you went to Liverpool. You did quite a bit of research in this. Little, I mean, it's really kind of an extended profile. What is about twice the length of one of your profiles?
Maybe twice the length of an old-fashioned New Yorker profile. Yeah, not the three-part piece about wheat that they used to run in the 1950s and 60s, but it's about 30,000 words, which is it's maybe about three Vanity Fair pieces or two long New Yorker profiles.
And which you've done some wonderful ones, like your one on Jerry Lewis. I love that.
Thanks.
Back in 2000, I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I did a lot of research, and I spent some time in Liverpool. And Liverpool is a powerful place. Despite what they've done to it, it remains a powerful place. You know, they put in this giant mall in which, when you're walking around, you could be in Minneapolis or Cleveland, and they have smoothed out the waterfront and put up all these mirror glass office buildings. And yet, despite all these things, and despite the ripping down of the cavern, which a scandalous event happened almost 40 years ago at this point, and all those old red brick buildings that used to make Liverpool, it's still Liverpool, and the Mersey is still the Mersey, and those childhood homes of John and Paul are amazing places.
You know, also touching to me was the childhood home of George Harrison, which is
just this
row of brick walls and little doors.
Yes.
There were kids playing outside. That particular thing, that's not any kind of national monument. It's just this house where a bunch of people live.
House where a bunch of people lived, and as with Ringo, no indoor toilet. How about that? You know, I mean, this was, it was a tough town.
Even Paul's house had at that time, I guess, had the toilet out in the
closet. They did have a toilet inside, but there's a toilet in the backyard as well. But the toilet and the bathroom were two separate rooms. And again, when you walk around that house, the amazing thing is how they were really on top of each other, even the three of them after Mary McCartney died.
And the working class hero lived in this lovely home surrounded by grass and fence.
Yes, he did, right? A budding strawberry field.
Yeah, yeah.
The big orphanage with the lovely grounds.
And you also went and saw the spot, that is the place where Paul met John. It's interesting that meeting at the fete.
The Woolton Parish Fete.
Yeah, these two guys met and it changed our lives.
And it was just a hot afternoon in July 16th, 1957, and a sort of fun outdoor church fair with rides and lemonade and ice cream and performing dogs and performing horses and this little skiffle band, the Quarrymen, these high school kids, basically, with strumming their instruments that they didn't really know how to play that well. And yet their leader, who is strumming on a four-string guitar and using banjo chords, he can't really play the guitar, and he doesn't even know the words to "Come Go With Me," but he's making up his own words, and he's singing in tune, and he's got an amazing hoarse voice, and he is totally magnetic and looks exactly the way he would when he starred with the Beatles, is the 16-year-old John Lennon.
Well, what about you? Were you a Beatle fan?
I was a huge Beatles fan. It is saying absolutely nothing special about me that I was like 18 zillion other people. I had my life changed on February 9th, 1964, when they performed on Sullivan. It was I was 12 years old, and I, like the rest of the country, had just undergone the assassination just 3 months before, and it was an awful and a brutal time in the life of America. Everybody was sunk, mired in sadness, and it was a sadness that was not going away. And suddenly, out of absolutely goddamn nowhere, was this thrilling jolt of joy. These guys, nobody had ever heard of them. I guess I had heard a little something on the radio. But they were quite phenomenal, and the screaming of the girls in the audience, which seemed so amusing to all the adults watching that little tiny round black and white TV, to me really was stating the reaction I was having deep in my soul. It was not anything excessive. It was I felt the same as they did.
It's interesting that three of the people that particular reaction that the Beatles got, I think only four people have really gotten it,
yes.
And that would be Sinatra,
yes,
Martin and Lewis,
yes,
Elvis,
yes,
and the Beatles.
That's
you haven't written about Elvis, but you've written about the others.
Well, Elvis has Peter Guralnik, who is very good at his job. So mm-hmm. I'm not gonna get into that business. But yeah, I have written about three of those four phenomena, and the Beatles, took it to a different height altogether.
Yes, because the screaming never stopped.
It never stopped, and of course it blotted out the music, and ultimately drove them from touring. It stopped them, paradox of paradoxes, stopped them from performing for the very people who couldn't get enough of them.
Yeah, and which drove them to a greater artistry in the studio.
Yes, it brought them into the studio. It bonded them even further with George Martin, who was every bit as much of a genius as they all were. And they all were. And that's the further astounding thing. Even when you look at Ringo Starr, poor Ringo, I think, who sometimes gets a little bit down on himself and gets the short end of the stick and the worse end of the reputation, was an absolutely brilliant drummer. And he was the other part of the Beatles, besides their musicianship and their wonderful performing charisma, was just, and this is the other thing that happened in 1964, in June or July of 64, was A Hard Day's Night. And you saw that these guys were not only amazing musicians and amazing singers, but they were movie stars. They had this dry Liverpool humor, courtesy of Richard Lester, who really facilitated it, brought it onto the screen, and Alan Owen, who wrote that wonderful screenplay. They were guys that you just couldn't get enough of being around, and that is it's a very, very rare thing. And I not to make odious comparisons, but looking at videotape or films of the Rat Pack in Vegas just doesn't. It's not quite as charming as
A
Hard Day's Night or any Beatles press conference, for that matter.
And it's interesting how Ringo at the press conferences was the one with the, you know, quick on the trigger with the jokes. He was very funny.
He was very funny and a very poor Pete Best, who is still very much with us. A very integral part, Ringo was, of the Beatles' magic.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I always wondered, well, why did they let Pete go, and was it his drumming or whatever? But then years later, I heard an interview with Pete Best, I think that Terry Gross did on her show. And I realized, you know, it's not that Pete Best, the thing was, Pete Best wasn't as, he wasn't as with it, he wasn't as clever, he wasn't great.
There's nothing to be gained by piling on Pete Best, but he wasn't one-eighth the drummer Ringo Starr was, and he just wasn't as clever as those four guys.
Yeah, it had to be Ringo.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people who Ringo was their favorite Beatle. I mean, everybody had one, right?
Yeah, everybody had one, and I realize we're here to talk about Paul, but I also thought that the Scorsese film on George Harrison was amazingly poignant. It left out some important things, but it had so much wonderful stuff in it, and I found it very moving.
Well, I did too. It was a great film, and I think it'd be nice to have a Paul McCartney film, for that matter.
That would be a complicated piece of work, wouldn't it?
Well, you'd have to include ballet.
Yes. Yes, you would.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy, he can, I mean, he's written movie soundtracks, he's written symphonies, he's written oratorio, he's written ballet, he's written avant-garde electronic music.
Ambient electronic music, which is, I will say, it is surprisingly lovely, surprisingly listenable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can put on The Fireman and listen to some of those songs named after colors, I was just listening to some before we began talking, as a matter of fact, and the striking thing to me is that the instrumentals, to my ear anyway, sound like Paul's voice.
Well, you know, I think if you ever listen to I Will, which I'm sure you do frequently, the bass on I Will sounds like Paul's voice. I think Paul is, rather than playing bass, I think it's his voice.
Ah.
I've never been able to figure it out for sure. So when I talk to Paul, when we have him on the show, I'm going to ask him about that.
Yes, when the three of us, yes, exactly, have a colloquy.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to talk about, Paul. I mean, you know, I once had someone on here who said, and I don't want to mention any names, Robert Hilburn, he said, Paul McCartney hasn't recorded anything good in 20 years. And I said, well, gosh, you know, have you listened to Flaming Pie and... have you listened to Memory Almost Full and Chaos and Creation? He says, no, because it's junk.
Yeah. And there's Junk. That's another.
Yeah, there's another great
McCartney
song right there.
It's a foolish statement. The guy just, he oozes genius. And the fact is that his greatest genius came with the Beatles, but he has favored us with it ever since, and it's not to be deprecated that he continues to write.
And so do you, and now you've written this wonderful little book about Paul McCartney. I guess the title of it is Paul McCartney.
Is that what they call it?
I think so.
That's not too bad.
If you're looking for it on Amazon, it's Time Magazine, Paul McCartney. And if you're looking for it on your newsstand, it's the book that says Paul McCartney on it, and it's got a picture of Paul.
Yes.
And everybody should get it. And thanks for writing it, and thanks for talking about it here on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, as always, Gary, I would discuss the phone book with you. It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
Well, that's it for this edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a nice time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or look us up on Facebook and iTunes. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. I want to thank our guest, James Kaplan. He's the author of a new book about Paul McCartney, published by Time Magazine and on your newsstands now. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time. We'll be back with the phone book after this.
Okay.